This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York, flococomuseum.org. And Meadow Garden, home of George Walton, one of the youngest signers of the Declaration of Independence. Open for tours Monday through Friday, 10 to 4. Learn more at historicmeadowgarden.org and visit augusta.com.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history, with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with Margaret Seidler, author of the book Painful Business, Charleston's Journey to Truth.
Margaret thought she knew her family's history. Then a genealogical search online led her to connect with a cousin who, unlike Margaret, was black.
Determined to find as much as she could about her lineage, Margaret soon came face to face with more than just an expanded family tree, and what she found led her to devote years to historical research and many difficult conversations about the centrality of the institution of slavery in Charleston and the part some of her ancestors played in helping it flourish. Margaret, it's great to have you with us today on the Journal. I think we need to let our listeners know before we start out, I have known you for quite a while because when I first joined the Army Reserve, I was the aide to your father, who was the commanding general of the 120th Army Reserve Command. And that's how I first met you. And over the years, I kept up with your dad and through him, you. So now you have written this incredible book, and I need to describe it for our listeners. If you just look at it, you might say, oh, this is a beautiful coffee table book, but looks can be deceiving. This is an incredible book. It's a journey that you made from the Charleston in which you grew up to the Charleston of the 21st century. How did it all come about, Margaret?
Well, first, I want to say, Dr. Egger, that it is such an honor to be with you after 50 years, because you're someone that we've always admired and talked about. And so to be here to talk to you about the journey that I've been on for 6 years now is really special to have this ability. So back in 2018, a friend of mine got a DNA test and found out that she had a very concerning health marker, and she told me about it. And so I went back and revisited one I'd taken probably 6 years ago, so a total of 12 years ago. And lo and behold, I didn't have any concerning health markers. What I did find, though, was a message from somebody that had been sitting there for almost a year, and it was a cousin. It was what they call a DNA cousin. And this cousin was of African descent.
I know what your mom and dad, how they might have reacted to that. How did you react to that?
Well, I reacted very positively and with great curiosity. Because if you just recall, in 2015, we'd had the Mother Emanuel AME Church massacre in downtown Charleston. And that really had a profound impact on me and my husband, Bob. So we had done a lot of work in the Charleston community trying to bridge the racial divide. As a matter of fact, we were at the time attending a predominantly African-American church, Mount Zion AME, the daughter church to Mother Emanuel.
Isn't that right around the corner from Grace Cathedral where you grew up?
Yes, sir. It's adjacent to Grace Church where I grew up.
Okay. And when Grace was undergoing its renovation, they worshiped in that church.
That's right. So it's been a place that all of my life I have felt deeply connected to because in the Grace Episcopal way of worshiping, it was very structured. And we'd come out of church and you would hear the people over at Mount Zion and they were clapping and praising and just having a good time. So I knew there was something really unique about it. And it wasn't until we were told after the massacre that Martin Luther King had said that the most segregated day of the week is Sunday. And Bob and I said, well, we can do something about that. And so we started going to Mount Zion, which ended up being a great experience for us.
Okay. But this is a story about your family as well as a history, a historical journal. And I love the play on words that you use for the title. My daughters would say, they're always talking about puns, and this isn't quite a pun, but it's close. And the title is Painful Business, and I'm going to have to spell pain now. P-A-Y-N-E hyphen F-U-L. And of course, Payne was the name of your forebear, who was one of the largest traders and enslaved persons in the history of Charleston.
That's right. Yep. So what I talked to my cousin of African descent, and she said that they had a roadblock on this side of their family, and they couldn't go past the Civil War. And she didn't know who her ancestors were. And she said, well, if you know who your ancestors are, then I can just follow right along with you. And my grandmother, who was born in Charleston in 1882, who lived to be 100, had left a couple of handwritten pages. And so I pulled them out and I started looking at these names, names I really didn't know. One was Torrance, T-O-R-R-A-N-S, Torrance. And then another was Payne, P-A-Y-N-E.
Well, didn't you have a friend when you told her that you were going to start doing your family, researching your family, advised you not to do it, that you might not like what you found?
Exactly. I was warned by many people not to do it.
Well, you know, see, this is what's so funny when people talk about they're descended from X. Well, if you go back and were descended from an original settler of Charleston in 1670, you'd have something like 16,000 plus direct forebears. You're only tracing one line. What about the other 15,999 that are out there? And that's what you did. You started pulling at threads. When you do research, it's a puzzle. But it's also like you're finding a thread and you pull it, and eventually the past unravels for you.
It did, and it unraveled in a really big and shocking way.
Okay. Well, let's go into that. Talk us through that.
I thought I was from, on my mom's side, because my dad's was originally from Savannah, Georgia. On my mom's side, I thought I was from working class people up near what is the Cook River Bridge. It's called the East Side. And we really never talked about that. That's where our family was from, because it wasn't something to be proud of. And so what I found was the names on my grandmother's list, this John Torrance, that he had come to Charleston from New York City in 1758. And so this was 100 years earlier than I ever believed that my family was there. And so I looked him up on the internet, and I just did a basic search, and his name popped right up. And he was in the archives at the College of Charleston at South Carolina Historical Society's collections. And it said John Torrance was a partner in the firm of Torrance, Gregg, and Pogue, and that they were very wealthy merchants in Charleston in the 1750s, 1760s, and 1770s, and that they worked a lot in flax, the flax business, making from linen products, flaxseed, and that they brought hundreds and hundreds of enslaved from Africa.
Okay.
And that was breathtaking.
All right, we've got Mr. Torrance, but where do we get Mr. Payne?
Well, Mr. Torrance's daughter, Maria Margaret, married William Payne in 1791 in Charleston. And he came over from Ireland. He was brought over by Pierce Butler, who's one of the four signers of the Constitution from South Carolina. So he had been the son of servants over there. So he came in about 1786. And he did for a while have a retail business, and I think that that just didn't go very well for him. And he went bankrupt in 1802. So he got into a much more lucrative business, which was the domestic slave trade, which meant these weren't captive Africans coming across the ocean. These were people who were already living in this country.
In fact, that's something people often overlook. 1801, the slave trade, external slave trade, is closed. But those large slaveholders up in Virginia and Maryland, where the land is going bad, are shipping those enslaved persons south by the thousands.
Right.
And Charleston was a major market.
Now, and Walter, briefly, let's mention why the land was going bad there.
The land was going bad in Virginia because they had been growing tobacco for over 200 years.
Hmm. Basically depleting the soil because they weren't rotating crops, right?
Nobody did. Very few, I shouldn't say nobody, very few people did scientific agriculture in the Old South. The land was so plentiful. I mean, there were exceptions, but most people just, particularly when you got to the Cotton South, they planted a couple of hundred acres, and then after 2 or 3 years, they let that go fallow, and they cut down some trees and cleared some land out, you know, more land. Hmm. When you see, when you own hundreds and hundreds of acres, which was, were not that difficult to acquire, you didn't worry about all that nice stuff of the expense of fertilization and and that kind of thing.
Well, what was so interesting to me about William Payne and this whole trade was that it was ubiquitous. It was everywhere in the South. So in the 30 years from 1800 to 1834, when he was in business on Broad Street, there were about 25 to 30 other businesses doing the same thing. I mean, this was the core of South Carolina's economy. And so I went back and I found online, I had to get it out of an antique shop in Texas, no kidding. It was my South Carolina history book that had a picture of the state capitol on it, and this is what we all studied. And so I went back and read my history book, and it was like, I don't know who was reporting on this history, but it wasn't somebody who was really aware or wanting to describe a more complete picture of what Charleston looked like. So early on, one of the connections that I made for Payne was that his biggest auction, his biggest two-day auction, was of 367 human beings, and it was the estate of John Ball Sr. And I found it in this book called Slaves in the Family, written by Edward Ball back in 1998. And I can remember reading that book in 1998 and going, oh, I went to school with all these people who have these last names. I learned so much. And what I realized was that we had never even talked about slavery in our family. It was sort of just like this thing that just was in the past, and it really didn't matter anymore. I mean, I grew up in the Country Club of Charleston in the 1950s. My parents built there in the 40s, and we were adjacent to McLeod Plantation. And while the kids in our little neighborhood had a swimming pool, a golf course, tennis courts, and a small boat marina, the children who were still living in the cabins adjacent to the big plantation house had no running water. They were playing in the dirt.
But you didn't realize that at the time.
I didn't understand it.
Okay.
It was dissonant for me. I mean, I can say that in retrospect.
Okay. And as you said, when you had history in the third grade or the fifth grade or the seventh grade, what school children, not just in South Carolina, but almost anywhere, and not specifically the South, it was everywhere. The Old South was a rather gone with the wind image, or even Uncle Remus type of kindly elderly African Americans and their devoted little white children.
Right. I went back recently and read for the third time, twice as an adult, Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Or when did you first read that?
I think I read it in high school.
50 years ago?
Yeah.
I think that's unusual that you were reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was a diatribe against the South and slavery.
And it was a real, that's why it's so impactful as an adult, is that it really, the book helps you understand families and the fear of an owner dying. And most, not most, but many of William Payne's auctions were estate sales. Some were from mortgage debt, some were tax lien with the city of Charleston, but many were from estates. And just to imagine that you've got your children and your grandchildren, and all of a sudden the person who owns you unexpectedly dies, and now you don't have any idea where you're going to end up.
And there are historians who have done stories of the domestic slave trade, and the myth that everybody was sold as a family is a bunch of baloney. Each enslaved person was a piece of merchandise.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, occasionally a mother with young children might be sold as a group, but that, even that was rare.
Well, when I was doing the research, and I have over most of my research initially before we did the book, but my basic research was over 1,100 newspaper ads from the Charleston area newspapers every time that Payne sold somebody. And so,
excuse me, you uncovered more than 1,100 advertisements that your forebear had in the paper.
Yes, and I imagine I missed a few.
Were you going through by microfilm? How were you finding those?
I was doing microfilm initially till Malcolm Hale, who's with the Charleston County Public Library, said, "We have that digitized." And so then I was able to use a search engine. So what I did was I spent like a whole summer in 2018 looking through these and found over 1,100, added it up, and determined that William Payne and his two sons had sold upwards of 10,000, actually so far 9,268 human beings over their 35-year career. They also dealt in runaways. One thing that gave me heart was that I saw that families were being sold together. And so I went to Nick Butler, who's the head historian at the Charleston County Public Library, and I called him up and I said, "Oh, Nick, I'm so glad I found a redeeming quality for William Payne. He's keeping families together." And he goes, "Margaret, I don't know how to break this to you." He says, "That's not accurate." He said, "Families were more valuable if they remained together so they could get more money for them." And so that was when I faced the facts.
So this was purely an economic thing for him.
Oh, totally economic. And what's amazing is where the building is at what's called 34 Broad Street today. It was a three-story building. And on the first floor, he had his office where he did private sales.
Right.
On the second and the third floor, he lived there with his wife and raised his four children.
Wow.
Right? And so he had people in pens that he would be having these private sales on the first floor. Just a few blocks away near the old exchange building, he owned the corner of what's called Gillen and East Bay Street, which today is a vacant lot. But that was a two-story brick building that was his, quote, vendu office. Vendu meaning auction or public outcry. So that's where he did his auctions, right north of the exchange building, just a block away from his home. I mean, this was everywhere. This wasn't just, he wasn't some isolated entrepreneur.
Hmm.
I mean, these people were all over Broad Street. They were on East Bay Street. They were on State Street. They were on Chalmers. They were having sales outside this business district. They were selling them on King and Broad. They were selling them up on the College of Charleston campus.
Wow.
And this is really important, too, for everyone to realize that all of this is source documented. I had the best historians in Charleston coaching me on how to document every single thing that I found so that it can't be disputed. This is just a history that is an addendum to the history book that I had in grade school.
Well, as people were finding about your research, you talked to some contemporaries whose forebears had also been involved in the trade, and some people still are kind of squeamish about connections.
Very. So what I did first was I went through the Payne family tree, and I identified a whole bunch of new white cousins that I have in Charleston, a lot of people that I grew up with that I had no idea that we were related. And I would say all but one of them has been really, really supportive. Then I went to some of the other slave trading descendants whose families were aristocratic, which obviously our family wasn't, but their family was what we would say is a Charleston, old Charleston. And so because I had learned how to do genealogy in this research, it was easy for me to find them. And a lot of these people I grew up with, right?
Yeah.
And so I just call them. Hey, how you doing? Margaret Seidler here. And I will say that one person, a female, came public. She's actually listed in the book. And her third-great-grandfather, Alonzo J. White, held the record-breaking sale for the domestic slave trade in 1835.
All right. And that was when more than 600 enslaved persons were sold.
600 enslaved in
that
2 days.
That was the largest slave sale in the history of the American South,
yes.
American, or the United States.
Yes. It broke the record, which was Pierce Butler's grandson in Savannah, Georgia, with I think it was 436. So broke that by over 100. And then their relative, this would be John Ball Jr.'s father-in-law, had also died, and he sold another 170 the next 2 days. So 770 people sold at the corner of Broad Street and East Bay over 4 days, and there was no mention of it in the newspaper to say this is news.
Well,
to me, that was shocking. That is more telling than anything else, that it wasn't newsworthy.
The sale was advertised in the newspapers, but because it was so every day, it was not news.
It was not news.
It was not news.
It was who we were and how we thrived on the backs of others.
All right. Well, let's turn now to the book. Earlier I said, this looks like a beautiful coffee table book and looks are deceiving. And it's because you engaged a Columbia artist, John W. Jones, to do the illustrations. So how did all this come about? And let's describe those for our listeners. What is the basis of each of these illustrations?
In the book, there are 34 paintings that Mr. Jones donated the images for the book. And what he did was he did something that has never been done in history. And he took the black and white sterile newspaper ads, and based on his own research, he brought them to life and brought them respectfully into their full humanity, showing the different ways that they, in fact, built not only the Charleston Low Country, they built South Carolina, and they built our country. And these are highly skilled people. We have ship's carpenters, we have painters, we have blacksmiths, we have coopers, we have carpenters, we have patroons, which are people that are skilled in navigating the treacherous waters around the Low Country.
Well, I'm looking at Poultry Woman.
Oh, I love her.
Who was sold to satisfy a mortgage.
Yes.
And I'm going to read the ad.
Okay.
By William Payne and Sons, tomorrow the 8th instant before our Vendue office will be sold, an elderly Negro woman, a good field hand and poultry woman, with her 3 children, viz., a Negro boy, 21 years of age, field hand, a girl about 18 years of age, field hand, ditto, about 10 years old. The above Negroes are warranted in character and are only sold to satisfy a mortgage. Conditions, cash. And here you have an older black woman feeding chickens.
And she's beautiful.
Yes. They.
He brings a real humanity to the people he illustrated.
Oh, it's just...
So everything that's in these paintings have all been vetted by Dr. Bernie Powers, yeah. Who's professor emeritus of history at the College of Charleston, as well as Nick Butler. We wanted to make sure that everything in here was accurate. I mean, it is, I can't describe to you the experience of sitting at home in my home office over 4 months looking up these ads in this database, Newsbank Redux database, and they're actually one of the book sponsors.
All right. Did Mr. Jones choose the ads to illustrate, or was they your selection?
I gave him about 75 ads, and he picked 60.
Okay.
And he painted 60 in about 8 months.
Okay.
And he couldn't stop. I mean, for him, it was so important for him to have his people since he is an African-American, to have his people honored and recognized. And so we had an art exhibition down in Charleston back earlier this year, and people would come and see the ad. They would see the painting that he drew, and then the narrative that we created to describe the situation with the ad. And I was having people come up to me with tears in their eyes saying, I thought I always understood slavery. I never understood it until I saw them. And I think that that is what makes this project so special, is it has a Charlestonian's personal revelations of her life through Jim Crow, her looking back at slavery in a very different way, looking at it in a, instead of a way of sympathy, looking at it through a true lens of empathy and heart. And I think that his bringing these visuals, making these people real, they weren't objects.
Well, they were not just a name in an inventory.
Yes.
I can remember John Edgar Wideman, who did Father Along, African-American, came to South Carolina, and his family's roots were up in Abbeville. And he talked to a professor at Erskine College who was helping him with a local historian. And he would come up with the estate books, you know, and Wideman would say, he's just talking these are just names, or they're not people.
Right.
And it made him very, very angry. It's in his book. Said he, at one point, he really just had to clench his fist and bite his tongue, because when people, sometimes historians doing the history of slavery, oh, so-and-so was a Midland planter with 14 slaves. That's it.
Well, that's how I was raised. And so what this means to me now is that these were real people. And I learned so much. For example, oftentimes there are children for sale. And one of my favorite paintings is called A Likely Girl. And she's 13 and she's good about the house. And I looked at her and I thought, well, either she's currently separated from her family at 13, or she's going to be. And then below in the ad, it says a smart young boy of 11 or 12, he's being sold separately. And so I'm like, well, this is children for sale. And so in some of the discussions that I had with the historians in Charleston was that at age 8, an enslaved boy became productive. Mm-hmm. And that was often the trigger point for him to be vulnerable to being sold away from his family. And so when I speak to groups, which I'm speaking to as many groups as I can to try and help people see things more completely, is that, you know, can you imagine if you're a grandparent or a parent, can you imagine that this child that you love is all of a sudden taken away?
And I think we need to let folks know that that likely young girl wasn't necessarily destined for housework. She could be a field hand.
She could be destined for anything that she had no control over.
I need to just make a comment in light of an interview that a podcast we did just recently with Joseph McGill of the Slave Dwelling Project. He talked about growing up in South Carolina and his knowledge of the Civil War and slavery and things like that. He learned in a public high school. And what he learned in his public junior high and high school was that slaves, and they weren't referred to as enslaved people, they were referred to as slaves, were a part of an economic system that worked very well. They were valued, and therefore they were well cared for, quote unquote, and therefore relatively happy, and in some cases maybe better off than they would have been otherwise. And he came away from that just It was sort of like it was in the background of history when he read it. There was no humanization in those textbooks. And then when he became a park ranger, he had to begin to talk about the real history. And he had to find out by doing his own research and bringing these people to the forefront of his consciousness. And look what grew out of that, of course, the slave dwelling project. So,
well, Joe McGill has been an early supporter.
Yeah.
And he was someone we didn't know before, but we got to meet him through Herb Fraser. And I'd say that when I heard his podcast on the Journal, that was the same thing that we were taught. I mean, you know, Joe and I are about the same age, so we learned that same history.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I just can't imagine what it's like being of African descent in his shoes, having gone to high school and heard that.
No.
I just can't imagine it. I don't know that I'll ever be able to imagine it. I just know that he is a great leader and that his book, Sleeping with the Ancestors, is a powerful book and is gaining a lot of traction around the country.
Don't underestimate your book.
No. Because it's powerful.
Because it's powerful in two ways. The narrative is powerful for me as a white Southerner and someone who's known your family for over half a century. But the illustrations themselves, each one speaks. There are little things in the book that maybe only a historian would catch. Is your chapter subheads are a slave tag. Was that your decision?
That was an important decision that we made, and we made no reference to it just for those that might wonder what that was. So one of the things that I've been very intentional about in this book, and it has to do with my professional training, not because what I'm doing right now is not what I, well, it's what I'm doing. I didn't know this was what I was being trained to do. Apparently I was, is that I worked for years and years in change management. And what I learned in change management is that if you just try and push people to change, then you're going to get resistance back. And so I had some psychologists literally read through the book to see if there was anything that they saw that would create resistance in people that are of the same color, white, as I am. Because what we don't want to do is we want people to be able to receive and absorb additional history that they weren't taught before and not push it away. And because there is an ask in the end of the book, and the ask is that people look within their own circle of influence and find something that they can do, taking this more complete truth to bridge the racial divide. And we've had all kinds of different things happening in the last 2 months where people are taking what's in their influence and they're doing things to make a difference, a positive difference, building a relationship, holding a meeting, having somebody in their home for dinner, going into a space where they're not the majority color, whether it might be for me as a white person going into a black church or like I'm going to go to a gala in a few weeks. And someone who's in the book, Papa Smurf, I'm actually going as his guest. And so I'll probably be just, you know, one of maybe a few Caucasians that's in that group that night. And it's a group that works against gun violence. So I just think there are lots of us, lots of Americans that want this to be a great country. And I think one thing that Lonnie Bunch said recently when I heard him speak was he said that Lonnie Bunch, as head of the Smithsonian, said that we can use history to make us better. And I think I'm following his lead.
Well, one thing I learned teaching South Carolina history for 40 years is that history can make people uncomfortable, and that somehow that notion, people don't want to talk about something that makes them uncomfortable. But you can't ignore our history. And one of the things people don't remember is that for a majority of the time that South Carolina existed as an entity, it had a black majority population.
Right.
and a very large black majority, much greater than Mississippi or Louisiana, the other states that over time did have black majorities. From the time of the Civil War until the early 20th century, this state was 60% African American.
So that would be something that I didn't know until I started becoming that accidental historian. And it was shocking because these are things that you're not told. And when you bring up this whole notion of being uncomfortable, that's why I'm saying that this book is written with great care, not to try and poke people in the eye, right? Trying to open their eyes. So we've had really positive responses. And I've had a lot of the friends that I did go to school with at Ashley Hall, girls that I grew up with, men that I've known forever, and they come and whisper in my ear and say, thank you.
What are they telling their children?
I don't know. Well, I'm hoping that they'll use this book because I think that having visuals, I mean, this book would be nothing without Mr. Jones's work. I mean, it just would just be another story. But his work, his paintings, you know, the milliner, the oarsman, the fence repairer, the silversmith, the shoemaker, the cooper. I mean, they bring people to life. And someone asked Mr. Jones one time, how did it feel doing these paintings? And it was somebody who was African American. And honestly, I didn't have the courage to ask him that question. And Mr. Jones said, well, it felt sort of familiar. And so Mr. Jones grew up right outside of Columbia. He's 73, so he's just a year older than I am. And he said that they didn't have indoor plumbing till he was 13. So the book cover that has the woman with the boiling pot of water boiling the laundry, he said he saw that.
And I hate to say it, but we need to start to wrap up, Walter.
All right. Well, any last words for our listeners before we sign off today?
I just want to encourage people to see differences instead of being uncomfortable or scary, seeing the possibilities in our country, that we're all in this together. Martin Luther King once said, we may all have come over on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now.
I like that. And as the late Charles Joyner said, in this state, regardless of color, we have shared traditions.
Yes.
So, Margaret Seidler, the author of Painful Business, Charleston's Journey to Truth, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal. I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. I know that I did. In Painful Business, Charleston's Journey to Truth, Margaret Seidler has written about the realities of Charleston's racial history while highlighting the historians, journalists, and community members who worked to reconcile those truths, and the enslaved individuals whom she found advertised for sale in antebellum newspapers are brought to vivid life by artist John W. Jones. He truly uncovers the humanity hidden beneath those detached advertisements.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.